Welcome to Coming Up for Air, the Allies in Recovery podcast, with hosts Laurie McDougall, Kayla Solomon, and Dominique Simone Levine.
Okay, ladies, good morning. How are you this morning?
Okay.
Dominique, why don't you introduce our topic?
Good morning. Okay. So I thought occasionally we'd take a look at some of these well-worn sayings that exist out there in pop culture around families with somebody with an addiction issue. And today it's the trope, they've got to want it. They have to want it. There's nothing I can do. There's no point in doing anything really until they want it. And what is suggested with that tone is that they have to want it a lot, like 100% want it. They have to want it. I'm not going to pay for treatment. I'm not going to talk to them. I'm just going to stay away until they're ready.
Okay. I hate this. I absolutely hate this saying because, a whole bunch of reasons. I will tell you, as a family member, I heard this. My loved one had overdosed and we were in the hospital. I was standing there in the emergency room with one of the first responders, one of the EMTs, and she was standing next to me and she looked at my son and she shook her head no, and she said, they really have to want it, don't they? And I have to tell you, I could have turned around and punched her in the face when she said this to me, because that is so hopeless, such a hopeless kind of message to send to a family member, that I have to stand there and wait and wait and wait and do nothing until my loved one wants, and I'm putting the wants in quotes, wants this recovery. And I 100% do not believe that that is completely true. And what I'm going to say is this. I believe there is some element in truth in all of the anecdotal information, but when you narrow it down to that one small little element of truth, you miss the depth and breadth of what is actually true, right? You're missing like thousands of pieces in between of being able to take advantage of other truths when you narrow it down to this one little piece. And it did with me. I was really, I could have killed her and was like, that doesn't make me feel good even remotely. Like, I'm already feeling hopeless. I'm in the emergency room. He's overdosed. And now you're telling me there's nothing I can do until he wants recovery really badly. And what I have found is it's not true. It's not black and white. There is a whole thing of gray in here. And how much damage is done when people are spreading these anecdotal pieces of words and families can't figure out what to do or where to go and get help, and then just get frustrated and sit back and then just let things happen because they're waiting for their loved one to want it really bad.
Well, definitely what you're saying resonates. And the theory behind CRAFT is that this willingness, this motivation, this resistance, this denial, this whatever you want to call it, is constantly on the move. It's constantly going up and down in your loved one's mind. There are moments, I would guess, every day or two where they are pretty much ready to go, I know this isn't working. And then you start finding the justification for using, and then you forget the reasons you're putting on the con list, you know? And it goes up and down. And what we're teaching with CRAFT is you, the family, can start to see the ups and downs. And that's what we call wishes and dips, right? A wish is a moment for something good to happen, which is encouraging to maybe stretch yourself and aim for a healthier body or a little less drug use or maybe not the cocaine or, you know. And a dip is, you know, I feel terrible. Mom, I feel terrible, darling, and I don't know what to do. I just can't seem to get off the couch. There's willingness in that sound too. And so that's happening day in, day out. And if you start paying attention the way we ask you to become just really aware of your loved one's signals and how they think and what they say, you will catch these. And it's actually in those moments that you stand the best chance of having some kind of a window into a position where you can be heard. And you might bring up your little options list. Well, I've got some ideas that I've just been writing down as I've done a little research online, and here's this. And it's got a detox, and it's got an inpatient, and it's got a residential, and it's got community medications treatment, and it's, you know, so on and so forth. So it is the opening. And when you don't pay attention to the little percentages, the ups and downs of that, they got to want it. You're missing the entire show. And you're missing your ability to be effective in all of those moments.
But I think also what both of you are saying is that we have to get out of black and white thinking, because it's either all or nothing, or good or bad, or what's happening is one trail. And so much of life is about the little micro moments and micro desires and micro offers. And what I see with Craft and Allies is that we're really learning to look at these tiny little cues and make tiny little moves, you know, because so much of when you think about, especially when I first became an addiction, when I started working with people dealing with addiction, the first thing was like, they're either sober or not sober, or you're fully abstinent or you're using. And then over time, people started to look at harm reduction, which was revolutionary at the time, because that's gray. It's like, we're trying to keep people alive. We're trying to keep people safe. It's basically like, how do we hold on while they're going through their process? And you never know what little moment is going to open somebody up for change. And we don't know that. And we need to be really clear. We don't know. And we've talked about this recently, what it's going to take for somebody to actually be ready or willing to do something differently.
I love what you said. We don't know, because I think that's also a piece of they have to really want it, is assuming you do know. And it's assuming you know what's going on inside of that person's head, right? Or what they're thinking. And facts are, we cannot read minds. We cannot. And so this idea of they have to really want it, how do you know when someone wants it? How does an EMT stand in the emergency room and look at somebody else and go and shake their head no and go, oh, they have to really want it? Does that mean this person doesn't want it? And how is it that you know that? You have no idea. And I also think that this anecdotal kind of piece of information basically is, I think, was created without an understanding of what ambivalence is. This idea that actually your loved one has conflicting thoughts and ideas in their minds, and they are just not narrowing in to what is going to be their positive pathway at this point, right? And they're trying new things out, or maybe they're not putting a whole bunch of trying in, but understanding that actually maybe they're not trying, maybe they're not motivated to do a particular piece to better themselves. But as a family member, I can be on the lookout, and I can try and find those moments when I am witnessing ambivalence, when I am hearing my loved one say, oh God, I've got to stop using. I really wish I hadn't lost my job, or this or that. And then tapping into it and tapping into that piece of it, and not focusing on the fact that they said they don't want to live like this, and 20 minutes later, they're out using again. That's ambivalence. They can want both things at the same time. They can want to stop and want to use all at the same time. And it really depends on my response to them as to how I can help to motivate them in a more positive direction, which again, doesn't mean they're not going to go out and use in 20 minutes or whatever. It doesn't mean that, but at least I can intervene in a way and get them to stop and think. hey, I hear that it sounds like it's really difficult to stop. So talk to me about that. What's going on with that? Do you think there's maybe one or two little things that you could do that could turn you in a direction where you can stop using, or at least you can reduce your use? Do you have any thoughts on that? Would you like my help in finding some ways? No? Okay, I'll back off, but I hear you. I hear that you're struggling with this and you're thinking about this, you know, and then they go out, they follow, their motivation just isn't strong enough yet to moderate or to stop, or they just don't believe that they can, or whatever it is, but it isn't black and white. And it isn't them just sitting there saying, or trying to lie and trying to manipulate by saying, I don't want to use anymore. And then they're out using again. All it is it's just this conflict inside of them and they're trying to work it through.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about what that conflict is. The conflict is, here I have this wonderful thing that allows me to escape and not have to think about life, as they say in the 12 steps, on life's terms. It's like you have this ejector seat from life where you're spaced out, you're not connected, you're not, the only responsibility you have at this moment is to get more of it, which is your focus. But the focus is to escape from the day-to-day struggles of either your life or your emotions or your mental health issues. So what we're talking about is this, what I have come to think of is this self-medication piece, big time self-medication. And we're saying, can you go off your medication and be incredibly uncomfortable and in pain? And then hopefully on the other side of it, you'll find something that works for you.
Right, right. And can you break your primary habit of how you soothe yourself and take another road in that moment? That is so very difficult to do. And part of it is these options of treatment that I was talking about earlier, which if your loved one lives with you, perhaps you have sort of privately magnetized to the side of the fridge, you know, not the front of the fridge, but the side of the fridge. And maybe you've also been thinking of other things that used to compete for his attention or her attention, that they used to like to do. It's a sports game or the gym or a walk or the dog or whatever it is, but creating additional social options that, again, you put in front of them. If you catch this shift going on, you're aware of this shift going on, and you can see they're getting kind of edgy and antsy, and they're moving about. This is definitely signs of they're going to use within the next couple hours. So if you think you've got a couple hours and you want to try it, you might say, hey, it's a beautiful day. Why don't we run the dogs and then go get an ice cream? And you put something in front of them that might deter that path right then and there. And so you have a number of these. So you are actually just creating options. You're not making them do anything, but you've got the treatment options for the big questions, the homeless options for the big questions. But you've also got a bunch of things that you've thought of that are small things. Lori says, hey, let's just go to the corner and get a coffee. It has to be you in there noticing these changes in your loved one enough to call it manipulation, call it behavior change, call it behavior modification, call it whatever you want it. But this is what craft is telling us to do, is to be that practical, to get in front of things when we can tell we're cycling back. It's Friday. If he doesn't come home by 7, I've got a pretty good idea of what's going on. You know, so you're learning where to step away and where you can actually lean in a little bit. And I think when people are facing a difficult moment and the only thing they know to do is to pick up a drink or a drug, you've got addiction pretty much. So a whole point is to start moving them away with things that compete with that, even the little things. That's the whole theoretical base of community reinforcement approach. The parent of community reinforcement and family training, community reinforcement approach is for the person with addiction. And there's a special adolescent version of it. So it's adolescent community reinforcement approach. But there you work 12 weeks with a therapist and your young adult or your teenager or your adolescent. And basically you work on community connections. What's out there that you like? You know, where's the why? Why aren't you going? What happened? Can we get past it? You know, just helping that young person find these options that don't include drinking and drugging. And then hoping that 1 out of 10 times, 2 out of 10 times, 3 out of 10 times, they choose the alternative.
And what you're talking about too, Dominique, is actually helping people to learn how to tap into their recovery capital without being specific, you know, without telling them we're going to reach out and we're going to tap into recovery capital. That all it is, hey, what about playing a pickup basketball game? We haven't done that in a while. And we used to shoot hoops together all the time. Let's go and do that again. And that's, it's that capital piece of it. What do they have in their life that you can draw from to try and help steer them in a different direction? And also the other thing that, and you had said this earlier, the other thing that drives me crazy about this particular anecdotal information is the fact that people will often say they have to want it more than you, meaning that your loved one has to want it more than the family member or the person that's, and I'm going to say this, that's a lie. That's an absolute lie. They don't have to want it more than you. In fact, I bet you 95% of the time you want it for them more than they do. And I know it's frustrating, but you don't have to wait until they want it as much or more than you. You do have the ability to become empowered, and you have the ability to get in there and add in some recovery capital, intervene in a way through communication, through your interactive skills, where you are helping to influence and direct this person and creating an environment where they have a lot of things to pull from and draw from, opening up doors and options for this individual to help direct them into a place where they are recovering. And it may be baby steps at a time. And the other thing that I can't stand about this is another one of those like rock bottom sort of thing, because it indicates that there's a moment in time when your loved one all of a sudden decides, and it isn't until that moment that they are in recovery. And that is so not true. Recovery is a process. It isn't a moment in time. It isn't straight line. It isn't one moment and then that's it. They're in recovery. It's a process of learning about who they are and where they want to go with life.
Well, and it goes back to the original question, is they've gone really want it. And I think that's what happens. People want it and then they don't. And they want it and then they don't. And that's part of what you're describing, is this longer term process. It's like, I want it. Oh, it's too hard. I want it. Oh, that's so tempting. Oh, I want it. And remember that what we're talking about when somebody has been using substances is it's a very heavily beaten road that they're walking on. And so we're asking them to bushwhack with trying to, you know, not use and have a life and do all of this other stuff. And that's a lot harder. It's actually, no matter how hard their lives might look to you when they're using, it's much harder when they decide that they're not going to use.
Right. And oftentimes you'll see someone who's doing fairly well. They're really getting through things. They're doing fairly well. And then something traumatic or something incredibly difficult happens. The loss of someone that they care about, or, you know, even the loss of a job. And now it's a very challenging, difficult thing to deal with. And really things get triggered inside of that individual. They know. One of the easiest ways to get through this and to not feel is to go ahead and use that substance. And so it makes sense to me that the person may want or want recovery really badly, but what they're facing in that particular moment is so complicated and so challenging for them that the easiest thing is just to go and use. And they do.
And really what we're saying here from a political or policy standpoint is something that we call treatment on demand. Because a lot of the times people pick the use is because it's so difficult to imagine getting somewhere to get the help in that moment not to use. And that's a movement called Treatment on Demand. Literally, the doors of treatment are open and you can just walk through and you get help. And a lot of recovery work is being done, I know, in the states that we're working in and across the country to make recovery communities with doors wide open to paraprofessionals that help refer you to services. It is brilliant. It didn't exist in my day. In my day, it was so hard to get into care. It would take weeks of planning to get on methadone. You had to be on a wait list and you had to travel across really bad sections of town, and people got to want it, but it has to be accessible to them too. It sounds so like victim blaming to say, well, it's up to you to want it. Oh no, there are lots of little attempts and things and places and calls and readings and things that I do. It's just such a far reach to imagine getting into care. And that's, again, the role of the family with those options, with those ideas, and anything you can come up with is your role. You're shepherding, you're lighting that path for them in down this particular direction.
Great conversation. I love these talks about kind of the myths, or I don't even know if it's myths, but part truths, not the whole picture, kind of anecdotal information. So maybe Kayla, can you just kind of give us a summary? What did we talk about today?
Well, we talked about, does your loved one really need to want it? First of all, do they really need to want it? And then second of all, do they need to want it more than you do? And the truth is that what we're looking at is a much more subtle process, and people have ambivalence, and we're going to be dealing with their ambivalence. We're going to, you know, work on providing options and being open to their process. And what we're looking at is what's our part in helping to create behavioral change. But we have to start with our own behavior.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good week.
Thanks for listening. We hope this episode of Coming Up for Air spoke to you. If you're listening in today on a podcast platform that isn't the Allies member site, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating. This helps others find the show more easily. If you have a suggestion for a new topic or a guest for the show, please reach out through the Contact Us form on alliesinrecovery.net. Special thanks to our hosts, our guests, and our production team.